The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So welcome everybody. To get us started, I wanted to kind of see where we are. So Anne is also the teacher in me. So if everybody wants to grab a partner or someone near them and just share what you know about Clara Zetkin in about a minute. So what do you know about Clara Zetkin? That is about, so where you guys are is basically where I was when I was assigned this talk. So the conversation was something like this. It was like, hey, do you want to do a talk at socialism? Yeah, that'd be awesome. Okay, great. Clara Zetkin. What? Just like, so I was completely starting from nothing. So I've kind of put together what I think are some of her important contributions. And because I'm interested in feminism, I kind of looked at it through like how she helped develop the question of women's oppression within the SPD, or you know, the Socialist Democratic Party in Germany. So I'm going to kind of focus on that. I'm not going to talk too much about other stuff, but certainly if you have other things to share later on, I think that would greatly enrich the discussion. So when I thought about the people who kind of developed the class-based analysis of women's oppression and the ideas of women's liberation, I thought about Alexandra Kollontai, I thought about Eleanor Marx, Friedrich Engels, you know, but I didn't really know anything about Zetkin. And I didn't know anything about the important role that she played in kind of defining the focus on women's oppression in the early, within the socialist tradition. So after reading a number of her works and reading analysis on her positions, I think that we need to add her to the list of important women, and more specifically to posit her as one of the most important leaders to develop a militant socialist women's movement that clearly developed the ideas put forward by August Bebel and Friedrich Engels. In this talk, I will refer to the development of socialist feminism using the term as a counter to historical bourgeois feminism. More concretely, it's the development of the integration of the fight for women's equality within the socialist movement and struggle as a prerequisite for the emancipation of the working class and not an end in itself. So while Zetkin played a central role in developing a number of important positions and fought tirelessly against revisionism, World War I, and racism, as I said earlier, in order to focus this talk, I'm just going to talk about her decisive role in implementing a Marxist analysis of oppression into the German Socialist Party, both in theoretical and practical ways. In particular, I'm going to talk about three debates. One around women in the workplace, one around organizing women into unions, and then thirdly, the need to fight bourgeois feminism. And also, just for clarity within this talk, when I talk about bourgeois feminism, I'm talking about the middle and upper class women's movement who saw suffrage as sort of the ultimate end goal. So right off the bat, I'd like to say that Toni Kliff's Clara Zetkin and the German Socialist Feminist Movement, which is a pamphlet, was really instrumental in forming this talk. Hal Draper's collection of essays called Women and Class Towards a Socialist Feminism was also really interesting. And then I used selected writings edited by Philip Foner to kind of get some of the direct information from Zetkin herself. In addition, since our organization has written little about Zetkin, I welcome debate around issues that I address and others that I don't, since I did my best in developing what I thought were the most interesting and fundamental questions, but I'm certainly not, you know, the end-all, be-all authority. So to understand her positions within these debates, I think we have to understand both the historical development of feminism and also the role of socialist movements up to her entry in politics. So we're going to start with the Enlightenment, so we're going to go back a little bit. As the Enlightenment spread through Europe during the late 17th and 18th centuries, and questions around democracy and universal suffrage, of course only for men, developed, women were not isolated from these political discussions. There were important debates about women's subjugation and exclusion from political and economic independence. History books tend to kind of lump all of these ideas together and put forward this idea that there was one feminist movement. But Kliff explains, newspapers, pamphlets, and books usually speak about the women's movement using the singular. Three centuries of history, however, show that at no time has there been one movement. There always coexisted two separate movements with a more or less sharp struggle between them, quite often a deadly one, the movement of the leisured ladies of the bourgeoisie and the movement of the working class women. Again and again, history shows us that the working women's movement grew and developed through a struggle against bourgeois feminists. The sharpness of the clashes depended on the general development of class struggle. So when we think about those women who are included within the canon of important feminists, we think about primarily the bourgeois wing of the movement, who generally ignored the millions of working women for whom equality was more than a voice in the political system, but it really meant a material difference in their working conditions, and who were involved in revolutionary actions. So Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, probably a familiar name, one of the most well-known female authors of the period, demonstrates the bourgeois wing of the of that time poo-pooing working-class women and generally resorting to gendered stereotypes to explain the absence of struggle. So when she's talking about the Women's March on Versailles in September of 1789, or October of 1789, she wrote, "The march consisted mostly of market women and the lowest refuse of the streets, women who had thrown off the virtues of one sex without having the power to assume more than the vices of the other. They were, strictly speaking, a mob, affixing all the odium to the appellation it can possibly import, and not to be confounded with the honest multitude who took the Bastille. In fact, such a rabble has seldom been gathered together." So basically referring to these working women as rabble and a mob. So Wollstonecraft represented many liberal sympathizers who would have preferred the political transition that was occur at the hands of the middle classes. When she talks about women, she talks about women of the middle class. Beyond her criticism of the masses, Wollstonecraft she illustrated a belief that was held by many middle and upper class women who disdained women's abilities, that it was impossible that a separate feminist movement would appear. And this, she was very emblematic of the predominant strains of early feminism. So Draper argues, in more modern parlance, Wollstonecraft speaks and thinks as the champion of the aspiring business and professional career woman, who has essentially the same attitude towards the mass of the female sex as have the male exploiters in the dominant society. She is just as determined to get her rights over their backs. So at the same time that Wollstonecraft and other writers were writing, women's organizations were developing on the ground. So in France in 1793, for example, the Society of Revolutionary Women was created. It was the first and only organization that openly proposed to organize women for participation in political life on the same terms as men. The women organizing in the Society of Revolutionary Women were not just organizing against the monarchy. They were also organizing explicitly for equality within and without the organization. This organization, developing alongside a revolutionary movement, represented for the first time the beginnings of an organized movement for the equality of women. While there were certainly feminist ideas before this period, it took the broader struggle for democracy and the experience of organizing to help solidify a movement with demands. So despite the brief growth of a working class women's movement during the French Revolution, the early 1800s reflected a retreat from working class feminist politics in France and a continued stagnation in other parts of Europe. In France, the growth of the revolutionary women's movement was destroyed by the Robespierrist regime, and women were banned from political life. The struggle that had helped to create the fertile ground for a rising women's movement was defeated at the same time the working class women's movement lost its strength and wouldn't be revived until the Paris Commune of the mid-19th century in France. So during this time, despite the continuing impact of Enlightenment ideals, which argued for, you know, freedom and liberty and equality and all of those things that applied to men, other philosophical currents served to maintain the oppression of women in European society. So German philosophers such as Goethe and Schiller had contributed to a German idealism that had romanticized love and the nature of women. This philosophy was in direct contradiction to emancipation because it deified women as angelic beings to be worshipped without needs of their own. The characterization of women as somehow supernatural supported the idea that they were also self-sacrificing and selfless. When middle-class women were forced to enter the workforce in the middle of the 19th century, which was considerably after working-class women, you know, had been involved in the workforce, because of economic changes which made their financial situations unstable, the ideology that accompanied these financial requirements and characterized the bourgeois women's liberation movement held on vestiges of this ideology, basically the expectation that women idealized selfless devotion. They weren't just working for themselves, they were working, you know, they owed service to the people. So these were kind of the ruling ideas of the time. But as women's clubs, women's journals, women's meetings, women's demonstrations, and women's demands spread throughout Europe, they took on different characteristics based on the historical political conditions of the particular country they were in. So to go back to France in 1948, so we're moving forward a little bit, working class feminist ideas emerged again alongside the Paris Commune. So, you know, it makes sense. There's a rise in struggle. There's a rise in a sense of, you know, the feeling that one can change one's own life. But again, the rift between the bourgeois feminists on one side and the working class women was immense. While intellectual feminists made their voices heard through writing, working class women fought alongside men for better wages, working conditions, and union representation. Since these struggles were rooted in making fundamental changes to circumstances on the ground, but weren't clearly linked to an ideology, they often coexisted with the continuing conservative ideas about women's place and about the family. So for example, the French novelist who wrote under the pen name George Sand chastised the bourgeois feminists, but focused on a narrow platform of female pleasure without offering any alternatives to the wider system. In fact, Sand subscribed to sexist arguments that women were not yet fit to fill leadership roles. Jean Durone, on the other hand, represented a healthier development of working class feminism, so occurring at the same time. She was a working class militant who developed as a leader at the outbreak of the revolution in 1848. She immediately ran an electoral campaign to place center stage questions of socialist feminism. The placard announcing her candidacy read, "I present myself for your votes out of devotion to the observance of the greater principle, the civil and political equality of the two sexes. A legislative assembly composed entirely of men is as incompetent to make laws governing a society composed of men and women as an assembly of the privileged would be to discuss the interests of the workers, or as an assembly of capitalists would be to uphold the honor of the country." So Durone shows us the beginnings of this feminist movement that emphasized women's equality as a tool to fight for a better future and not just an end in itself. So in this respect, she and other activists like her laid the ground for Zetkin and Kollontai. So despite these advances, the French faced huge difficulties in building a sustainable socialist women's movement throughout the 19th century. This was largely due to the fact that trade unionization rates were really low, and they were particularly low for women. So, for example, in 1906, only about 7% of workers were unionized, and only about 2% of working women were unionized. The French unions also continued to take the extreme anti-feminist position that women shouldn't be in the workforce at all. So then in Britain, different historical forces but similar weaknesses kept women from organizing. Unionization rates increased much more dramatically throughout the period, but many trade unionists and socialists maintain anti-feminist perspectives. So in both France and England, the socialist women had very weak links with male socialists, and they collaborated with bourgeois feminists and were often quite completely assimilated into them. In Germany, the situation was much different. So now we're starting to move to Clara Zetkin. So in Germany, the situation was much different, and this allowed for the development of, you know, the woman question, which is, you know, a terrible way of putting it forward, but that's how everyone refers to it. So part of this had to do with the development of the socialist movement in Germany. So Ferdinand LaSalle and his followers developed the first socialist organization in Germany, which had terrible politics around women and work. LaSalle was basically a state socialist and tended towards reformist politics that depended on a small number of cadre to maneuver and lead the working class. And his reaction to the feminist movement belied these tendencies. So at the time, women who were forced into the labor force to avoid poverty and help support their families were recruited into the workforce to break strikes and to keep wages and conditions down. And so when the LaSallians were faced with this reality, they took a reactionary stance. And so in 1867, 4 years after they were founded, they came out directly against the industrial employment of women and in favor of measures to keep women out of the factories. While economically motivated, these demands tended to take on a high moral tone for obvious reasons. Arguments about preserving the family and defending female morals could appeal to circles beyond their interest group. So in this way, the LaSallian socialists capitulated to the predominant obstructions to equality while reflecting bourgeois ideas about the role of women, arguing that they should remain in the home and not be integrated into the workplace. But as the number of women in the workplace increased exponentially, women began to organize within the trade union movement. The state responded to this by passing laws that limited women's right of association and assembly. This reaction was similar to trade unionists in Europe at the time. But by the 1860s, a much different way of addressing feminism was developed by socialist Auguste Bebel and William Liebknecht. in Germany, which helped set the stage for later developments. Babel and Liebknecht argued that women's ability to have economic independence by entering the workforce was essential to women's equality. I'm going to take a moment. So Draper argues that this was the first right-left split on the women's question in the socialist movement. In the Marxist perspective, the entrance of women into industry was not itself the solution. It merely posed the right questions for solution. It provided the necessary starting point for struggle. The struggle had to include a fight against the abuses of female labor, along with other working class struggles. Just as the Lasallians had extended their rejection of women's employment to rejection of women's suffrage and political rights, so also the Marxist approach pointed in the diametrically opposite direction to the integration of women in every aspect of social struggle, including the political. In spite of these developments, the German social democracy would not adopt a clearly pro-feminist position until 1891, but this was much earlier than its French and British counterparts. The fact that it did take this position was thanks to several important developments. One, that the foremost theoretician of Marxist feminism at the time was August Bebel, and it was his book, Women and Socialism, that laid the basis for this position. And the other is because of Clara Zetkin, I think. So it was Women and Socialism, along with Engels' Family, Private Property, and the State, which came 6 years later, which put the immediate issues of women's rights in their context as part of a broad historical canvas of societal development, part of the social struggle in which were integrated the militant aspirations of an oppressed sex and an oppressed class. The importance of the publication of Babel's book cannot be overstated. It served to fundamentally change the analysis of women's oppression by arguing against the bourgeois feminist position that the oppression of women was an unalterable and somehow natural state. It placed women's oppression within its historical context as the result of changing in economic conditions. Babel's thesis was that only through the destruction of bourgeois society would the working class and women be emancipated. This was markedly different analysis of women's oppression than previously theorized. Babel also argued that women need to leave the home for both economic reasons and to reach a higher stage of historical development by bringing them closer to economic equality with men. Babel believed that this would be good for the party because it would bring women into organizations, such as women's unions, and then by extension into the socialist movement. While there are certainly criticisms that can be made of Babel's work, including the economic determinism that answers women's oppression, Clara Zetkin argued that Babel's work should be judged within the context that it was written. Its basic argument that the emancipation of women was necessary to win a different society remains a tenet of Marxist feminism today, and it was the first text to relate women's oppression to historical development. So then, the other reason that the German social democracy turned towards including women within trade unions beyond the publication of Babel's book was the presence of Clara Zetkin and the role that she played in the party. Over the next 20 years, women developed as leaders of this Marxist-feminist movement, pushing the party to take clear positions. Clara Zetkin and Emma Ehrer, a prominent socialist, set up the paper Gleichheit, which means equality, in 1891, and this paper remained the center of the movement up until the end of World War I. The paper circulation increased exponentially throughout this period, developing from a few thousand to 112,000 in 1913. At the same time, the number of women in the party was expanding from about 4,000 in 1905 to 141,000 by 1913. The impact of the German socialist feminist movement led the movement worldwide. So now, at 15 minutes into my talk, I'm gonna talk about Clara Zetkin. So, Clara Zetkin. She was born July 15th, 1857, in Germany in a small village. She was the daughter of a teacher and an educated middle-class woman. Her mother was an advocate of economic equality for women, much to the dismay of her Protestant husband. In fact, her mother developed a society that provided evening courses to women in handicrafts, languages, and office skills. Clara attended the village school, her learning augmented by her father's tutoring. After impressing Auguste Schmidt, one of the developers of women's societies, Zetkin was able to attend a teaching training college free of charge. And at the time, this was the best secondary schooling available for women. She was especially interested in the ideals of the French Revolution, including the discussions about equality for women. And she became familiar with the works of Ferdinand Lassalle, and after receiving her teacher's certificate, she began attending German social democratic meetings in the lectures of William Liebknecht. When her parents and Auguste Schmidt frowned upon her radicalization, she broke off relations with them. And then shortly after this, she met Osip Zetkin, a Russian immigrant who was a developed Marxist, who she lived with and had two children with. By 1878, she was a committed socialist. But on the 21st of October in 1878, less than 6 months after she had first started attending socialist meetings, these meetings, as well as the party press, were banned under Bismarck's anti-socialist law. Clara then became involved in the illegal activities of the party until Osip Zetkin was expelled from Germany, and she followed him to Austria, Switzerland, and Paris, teaching and organizing. During her time in Paris, she attended weekly meetings of international socialists, and she developed an understanding of the international labor movement. She returned to Germany for a three-month visit in 1886, when she got back into contact with German comrades in Liebknecht and made her first public speech. She was received enthusiastically, and she made several speeches a week for the remainder of her visit. Many of her discussions centered around Bebel's Women and Socialism, which had been read by many working-class women who were eager to talk about it. She returned to Paris to nurse her ailing husband, who died in January of 1889. So, a few months after her death, she was chosen as a member of the organization committee to prepare for the founding Congress of the Second International, and she was elected to represent the working women of Berlin. She was one of the eight women among the 400 delegate Congress from 19 countries, and this was the beginning of her role in the German and international women's movement that would continue for 25 years. So I said I was going to focus on three major debates that she engaged in. So the first one I'm going to talk about is allowing women in the workplace. So one of her first contributions at the Second International Congress in 1889 centered around the role of working women in labor. While most trade union and socialist activities across Germany, Britain, and France, were arguing that women should be excluded from the unions and the workplaces because their presence would drive down wages, Zetkin argued that they should be considered part of the working class that would have to unite to win and struggle. To that end, she explained that women workers were exploited in the same way that men were. In a particularly clarifying analogy, Zetkin argued, if one demands the abolition or limitation of women's work because of the competition it creates, one might just as well use the same logic and abolish machines in order to demand the recreation of the medieval guild system, which determined the exact number of workers that were to be employed in each type of work. So sort of like you can't stop progress, right? In the same speech, Zetkin spoke about the necessity of economic freedom for women and against bourgeois feminist demands that asked for political rights such as voting as the ultimate question. She stated, "We do not expect our full emancipation by our admittance into what is called the free enterprise system or equal schooling with men, even though the demand for these two rights is perfectly natural and just, or the granting of political rights. Those countries which allegedly maintain universal, free, and direct suffrage show us its relatively insignificant worth. The right to vote, which is not accompanied by economic freedom, is more or less a change without direction. There would exist no social problem in the countries maintaining universal suffrage if social emancipation would be dependent upon the attainment of political rights. The emancipation of women, as well as humankind, will only occur within the framework of the emancipation of labor from capital. Only within a socialist society will women, as well as workers, attain their full rights." So one major disagreement at the Congress revolved around the question of special protections for women within the workplace. Zetkin argued that women should have no special protection. They should have and fight for the same protection that men, that all workers should have. It must be recognized that Zetkin's argument was formulated in response to organizers who felt that women shouldn't be allowed in the workplace at all because they would bring down wages. But she also later changed her mind a little bit regarding special protections, and we'll return to this idea later. Most socialists at the Congress still had mixed consciousness about the role of women in society. So even though they were, you know, socialists organizing, they held on to some of these sexist ideas. So she was in the extreme minority in her argument about allowing women in the workplace and allowing them, arguing that they should have the same, basically fight for the same rights and have the same protections as men. And she ultimately lost to a provision that stated that women should be forbidden in all branches of industry where the work is particularly damaging to the female organism, and that night work for women also be forbidden. However, in response to her arguments, the Congress passed a resolution that declared that male workers have a duty to take women upon their into their ranks upon the basis of equal rights. and demand in principle equal pay for equal work of the workers of both sexes and without discrimination of nationality. So this resolution was actually a far cry from trade union arguments against women within the workplace. And the Congress took a major step forward, in no little part, I think, because of the arguments and presence of Zetkin. And then another important step to come out of the Congress in Germany was the creation of the Berlin Agitation Commission, which consisted of seven women and later became the executive of the Socialist Women's Movement. So that was the first big debate that she was involved in. A little bit about her role within Gleichheit, which was the journal or the newspaper. So in 1890, the anti-socialist law expired and was not reviewed. Socialist organization and publications were able to come out from the shadows. So at the end of the year, JHW's socialist publishing house took over the publication of the women's journal Die Arbeiterin and changed the name to Die Gleichheit and made Zetkin the editor. This is a post she would hold for nearly 25 years, so really fundamental in the leadership of this paper. Zetkin saw Gleichheit as a tool to inform and have debates within the vanguard of the women's movement. In an article to the readers, which was republished every year throughout the 1890s, she stated, Gleichheit is directed especially to the most progressive proletarians, whether they are slaves to capital with their hands or with their heads. It strives to school these theoretically, to make possible for them a clear understanding of the historical course of development, and to make possible for them not only to work consciously in the battle for liberation of the proletariat, but also to be effective in enlightening and teaching their class comrades and training these as fighters with a clear goal. So Zetkin identified the paper with the Social Democratic Party and the political principles of the party's left wing. She also made certain that it served as a journal of communication and exchange for the organized working class women. And much space was devoted to descriptions of working class conditions and industries in which women were particularly numerous. Strikes and other forms of labor activity among working women in Germany or in other countries were always given prominent coverage and sympathetic support in Gleichheit. In spite of her attention to working women and her focus on their struggles, including working conditions and fight back, Zetkin was often criticized about the high theoretical level of the articles within the paper, which she wrote the large majority of for the early years. Her critics felt that their high theoretical level made them inaccessible to many women. However, Zetkin saw the paper as the foremost theoretical tool in developing questions and debates around women's oppression and not as a popular pamphlet. So, while editing Gleichheit, Zetkin also became deeply involved in the trade union movement in Germany. And this had a large impact on developing the next debate that I'm going to talk about, which is the question about organizing women in the workplace. With her knowledge of conditions of German workers and her familiarity with the operations of trade unions abroad, Clara Zetkin quickly developed into one of the most sought-after party speakers for trade unions, women's organizations, and party locals all over Germany. It has been estimated that in some years she delivered over 300 speeches. So that's pretty crazy. And her analysis ranged far beyond her argument that women should be included in the workforce. In an editorial in Die Gleichheit in 1893, she argued that trade unions reach out specifically to organize female workers alongside the males. So while she acknowledged that some headway had already been made, she pointed to the fact that out of 52 trade unions, only 14 had both men and women. She explained, given the fact that many thousands of female workers are active in industry, it is vital for the trade unions to incorporate them into their movement. In individual industries where female labor plays an important role, any movement advocating better wages, shorter working hours, etc., would be doomed from the start because of the attitude of these women workers who are not organized. Battles which began propitiously enough ended up in failure because the employers were able to pay off non-union female workers against those who are organized in unions. These non-union workers continued to work or took up work under any conditions, which transformed them from competitors in dirty work to scabs. So in the same article, Zetkin also acknowledged the special barriers to organizing women because of their traditional role in the home and as primary caregivers. And really interestingly, she recognized the elements of sexism within the working class. And she said, in order to fulfill the task of organizing women, two things are necessary. The male workers must stop viewing the female worker primarily as a woman to be courted if she is young, beautiful, pleasant, and cheerful, or not. Which I think is hilarious that she leaves in that or not. They must stop, depending on their degree of culture or lack of it, molesting them with crude and fresh sexual advances. The workers must rather get accustomed to treat female laborers primarily as female proletarians, as working class comrades fighting class slavery, and as equal and indispensable co-fighters in the class struggle. So then further developing her Marxist analysis of the role that the proletarian women would need to play in the struggle, in 1896 she published a pamphlet entitled Only with the Proletarian Women Will Socialism Be Victorious. So her focus within this document was to put forward a clear social analysis. The pamphlet was introduced as a speech to the Gotha Congress of 1896. And while a motion was made and passed at the Congress that the speech be made into a pamphlet, it appeared as a party publication, but not as an official party statement. In the speech, Zetkin linked her analysis clearly to Engels' work. This speech is particularly interesting because she develops on the idea that Engels put forward about the role that the development of capitalism had on women's oppression. While the advent of private property helped to stamp women as non-owners, she argues that it was the capitalist mode of production that first brought about the social transformation which raised the modern woman's question. It smashed to smithereens the old family economy that in pre-capitalist times had provided the great mass of women with the sustenance and meaningful content of life. Well, it seems that Zetkin is clearly romanticizing certain aspects of like a woman's daily life prior to capitalist production. The main thrust of her argument has to do with the absence of the kind of division of labor that capitalist production required. And more importantly, she goes on to explain that it was precisely this division of labor that began to raise the woman's question. Depending on their class, the question was raised in different ways and with different demands. So Zetkin goes on to clarify what the upper question means for different classes. So she says, for the family of the upper 10,000, which I've translated as the 1%, one of the central tenets of the call for equality is based on desire to control property, so to be able to inherit and keep wealth. I think it is, in essence, Virginia Woolf's cry for a room of one's own and a stipend, right? In the small and middle bourgeoisie, the women must fight for their economic equality with men through the demand for equality in occupational education and through the demand for sex equality in carrying out an occupation. So the struggle, you know, looks a little bit different than for middle-class women. It's not about inheriting wealth, but it's about being able to, you know, go to schools, be able to have jobs, things like that. And then in both these cases, the women are primarily fighting against members of their own class. But the struggle for women, for working women is different, or working class women is different. As Zetkin explains, the end goal of her struggle is not free competition with men, but bringing about the political rule of the proletariat. So while the class analysis of this speech is very useful, it must be noted that some of Zetkin's historical backwardness, that some of her historical backwardness and gender roles is clearly present here as well. She says that the struggle is a question of restoring and ensuring her rights as wife and mother. In another section, she argues that the organization must be careful not to alienate proletarian women from their duties of wives and mothers. So then beyond this analysis of sort of what women should be doing is her stereotyped argument later in this speech that advocates for a popular pamphlet for working women that was separate from Gleichheit because she said, what women workers get from the contents is not what is educational, but solely what is entertaining and amusing. So basically like disparaging, you know, the intelligence of working women. So despite some of its weaknesses, Zetkin's 1896 pamphlet illustrates her developing position on the origins of women's oppression. Previously, she had argued against special protection, so I'm going to go back to that argument. But now she explicitly called for special protections. Foner argues that this was her, you know, basically changing her mind, being convinced by Engels' arguments that women's biological function as mother, together with her relatively defenseless and weak social position, made legal protection an even more pressing necessity for the female than the male worker. And I think obviously, you know, I think that that's true, but I also think that to a certain extent, the two arguments are a little bit different. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, women should have the right to, women should be able to do, they can do the same jobs as men and they don't need to be excluded from certain areas of work because they're women. And then it's a little bit different to say, oh, but they do play this biological role as women, and so we should support things, you know, that, like I would liken it to like, you know, maternity leave, you know, or affirmative action. So things that provide special protection for women because of the role that they play in society and because of the history of oppression. So I think that that's kind of an open debate for me. Like, did she really change her position, or was it, you know, based on sort of like what the questions were that were facing her at the time? So those were the first two things I want to talk about, the role, you know, women in the workplace in general, women in trade unions as the second one. And then the last one I'm going to talk about is the need to fight bourgeois feminism. This is probably the thing that she's known most for, in particular because she kind of was so polemical about the way that she put it forward. So throughout much of her work, Zetkin is arguing against the women rightsers, who made women's juridical rights under the existing social order the be-all and end-all of their movement and program by detaching the question of women's rights from basic social issues and by making it a separate question. The importance of Zetkin's work is that it focused on the class nature of the two wings of the feminist movement. In contrast to the British and Americans' women's movement that sidelined radical reforms, they were widely accepted in Germany. And this made Zetkin's job of differentiating herself as a socialist from the radical women's movement more difficult. The movement was extremely diverse, and it went from fighting for the narrowest reforms on the right to the radical socialist demands on the left. And uniquely in Germany, many radical demands were part of the larger women's movement. So here's an example. In 1904, a League for the Protection of Motherhood and Sexual Reforms, which was, you know, a broader coalition from the mainstream women's movement, was founded. It was very radical. As far as the civil code was concerned, the new moralists wanted the legal equality of man and wife within marriage and also in their legal relations to the children of the marriage. They wanted easier divorce. They wanted the legal recognition of free marriages to the extent that the police interference, not unusual in such cases, would not take place, and that the children of such free marriages would be subject to the same legal conditions with regard to their parents' power over them and given the same legal rights as the children of legal marriages. They campaigned to encourage people to use contraceptives. This is 1904, you know? I mean, this is huge. They campaigned for the repeal of Section 218 of the Criminal Code, which stipulated that a pregnant woman who deliberately aborted her child was to be imprisoned for a period of between 6 months and 5 years. And this was applied even in the case of rape. So these you know, fairly radical demands were being taken up by the broader women's movement. And so because of this, on many issues, Zetkin and the women's rightsers found agreement, and she agreed that suffrage was important. So she didn't poo-poo, you know, the need for political equality. And she said that the desire for women's rights must be the central point about which any serious women's movement gravitates. And she didn't believe that the importance of women's political rights were useful simply as a tool for socialist revolution either. She felt that they were an essential weapon in the class struggle, but that they were a woman's right and a social right. So she saw, you know, that there was just this intrinsic right for equality, and you should fight for it, not just as an end, you know, a better way to fight for socialist revolution. But despite some of the common ground between the more radical bourgeois feminists and the socialists, Zetkin remained firm in her differentiation from the upper and middle class feminists. In a resolution introduced at the International Social Congress of 1907, Zetkin explained the debate with the feminists and the question around the right to vote. So she argued, "One would assume that in view of this situation, the entire politically disenfranchised female sex would form one phalanx to fight for universal women's suffrage. But that is not the case at all. The bourgeois women do not even stand united and determined behind the principle of full political equality of the female sex. They are even more reluctant to fight energetically as one united force for universal women's suffrage. In the final analysis, this is not due to the ignorance and short-sighted tactics of the leaders of the suffragettes' camp, even though they can be correctly blamed for a number of deficiencies. It is the inevitable consequence of the diverse social strata to which women belong. The value of enfranchisement stands in reverse relationship to the size of the estate. It is of least importance to the women of the upper 10,000, and it means the most to female proletarians. All of this does not mean that the female proletarians should reject the bourgeois suffragettes who want to march behind them or at their side in the battle for the women's right to vote. They may march separately, but fight together. But the female proletarians must know that they cannot acquire the right to vote in a struggle of the female sex without class distinctions against the male sex. No, it must be a class struggle of all the exploited without differences of sex against all exploiters, no matter what sex they belong to." So Zetkin was often a harsh critic of the feminist movement because of its limited scope and its potential for dividing the movement. Zetkin argued against the narrow political fight that excluded full voting rights for all classes. In part, this was because she faced other socialists that supported limited suffrage for women. So there were actually other socialists who said, well, you know, we should take what we can get if what we can get right now is limited suffrage for women, meaning suffrage for, you know, the middle and upper classes, then, you know, that's a step forward. So she argued that the Socialist Congress should take the position of universal women's suffrage. She said it's not accurate to view women's suffrage as a practical step towards the eventual political emancipation of female proletarians by universal suffrage. On the contrary, by increasing the political power of the proprietary class, it strengthens the reactionary forces which oppose the further democratization of the suffrage in favor of the proletariat and without distinction of sex. Additionally, she argued it allows the pacified bourgeois women to drop out of the battle for political equality of the female entire female sex. There's not one country in which the administrative and legislative bodies have been elected by limited women's suffrage where the politically emancipated women have fought with all their strength for the civil rights of their poor sisters and for universal women's suffrage. So basically, like, once they get their rights, they will drop out of the fight, right? Because there's no further incentive for them to be involved in the struggle. So just kind of in closing, Zetkin is widely seen as the key figure that determined the early German ideology of the women's movement. But despite her role as the editor of Gleichheit and her continued leadership in the SPD, her relationship with the rest of the leadership was often tumultuous. Some of this developed out of her steadfast resistance to the growing reformist movement, and some of it was the result of her continued polemical response to bourgeois feminists. I'm going to skip that section, except for, you know, Engels supported Clara, and he said, Clara's right, bravo, Clara, which I thought was cute. So, you know, as the number of women involved in the organization increased dramatically, and later when the right wing of the SPD took control of the women's movement, Gleichheit changed dramatically. It began to contain and supplement, and later was alternated with the supplement of reading material for women and children. So the real content of Gleichheit changed. Zetkin made the most out of these decisions and included educational material for women and selections from European writers. But then after the outbreak of World War I, Gleichheit became the voice of opposition to the war, but Zetkin was repeatedly censored by the leadership. Increasingly, there were these blank columns left in the paper to show what, you know, she wasn't allowed to print. She was arrested several times during the war, and the war itself was fundamentally changed the SPD's relationship with the bourgeois feminists. In fact, out of Zetkin's hands, Gleichheit declared in 1917, in practical matters, we can learn many things from bourgeois women. So, you know, totally moving to the right. Zetkin helped develop the USPD and then led many of the rank and file into the KPD. And after Luxembourg and Liebknecht's murder, she was the most important pre-war socialist leader in the KPD. She served on the Central Committee from 1919 to 1923 and again in 1927. She died in 1933, shortly after Hitler seized power. So that's Clara Zetkin. And I welcome, you know, your comments, thoughts, and anything that you think is super important that I didn't talk about.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.